This podcast was recorded at Hartford Street Zen Center, Isanji, in San Francisco. Please help support our temple by making a donation at hscc.org.
Good morning.
Good morning. Good
morning. Please excuse me for not being at Zazen last period. The migraine demons are back, so kind of trims my wings, so to speak, a little bit. I periodically, and maybe especially in the Zen school, people say things like, fundamentally, there is nothing lacking. Or, the world is perfect just as it is. I suppose you could, or maybe some people hear remarks like that and think that they are, I don't know, a pronouncement about reality that we're supposed to agree with. But that's a mistaken view, I think. They're teachings. And as such, there'll be a time and a context for them that is appropriate, and also occasions when they're not appropriate at all. So the question is, not just for me, but for all of us, is how to help people. Yesterday, David and I attended a very warm-hearted event over at UCSF. Reverend Hokai, who is looks like sinking slowly in the west over there, graduated.
I'm resting my back.
Ah, okay. Graduated from a very rigorous program of hospital chaplaincy training. Yes, bravo. There was much applause. And it was a very moving ceremony. And as I was watching, it was very clear that for chaplains, and anybody in the helping profession, but maybe especially hospital chaplains who so often encounter people in extremis, you know, in very difficult, painful situations. And the question constantly presents itself, how to help. I imagine it's not unusual, just based on my own experience, it's not unusual to actually have no immediate answer to that, necessarily. Entering a situation, maybe, for the first time, with people you don't know, and it's clear that there is need for some help. But what that help should be is not so clear. And one of the mistakes that we can make is to try to generate or produce something from our own side that is based on kind of what we think might be helpful without including all the other beings who may be present. So maybe one good way, probably one bad way would be for me or Hokai-san or anybody to enter a hospital room, say, where maybe someone's dying, maybe it's a child, and to say, "Don't worry, the world is perfect just as it is." I wouldn't be surprised if you got shot for doing that. Now, there might be circumstances where that's helpful, but what I'm getting at is we need to let those other beings, whether they know that's what they're doing or not, tell us what's helpful. Tell us what's needful. And of course, it doesn't have to be in words. It may be a little slow taking shape. But the magic is to allow Guanyin to manifest her thousand hands and eyes. And she is one who can certainly be invited, but she can't be commanded. So you'll all remember the famous story about our great ancestor Yunyan and his Dharma brother Dao Wu. I forget which one asked the other, but anyway, let's see. Yunyan asked Dao Wu, "What does she do with all of those hands and eyes? What does she use her thousand hands and eyes for?" Wu says, "You know, it's like reaching for your pillow in the middle of the night." And Yunyan says, "Oh yeah, I get it." And Wu says, "Well, what do you get?" And Yunyan says, "All over the body are hands and eyes." And Dao Wu says, "Well, that's pretty good, but that's only 80%. Typical Zen gain here. And Yunyan says, "Oh, well, what do you say?" Dao Wu says, "Throughout the body, hands and eyes." So these hands and eyes are, because they are throughout the body or all over the body, you cannot count them. They are beyond counting. So that means we need to trust their functioning. it's not at all like some magic trick pulling a rabbit out of a hat. Great teacher Wansong says, oh no, sorry, Hongzhe. Hongzhe says, the present hands and eyes manifest the whole works. Means the hands and eyes right now manifest the whole works. He says, you say, selflessly, effortlessly, spring spreads upon the branches. Unhindered, the moon travels the sky. These are poetic evocations of that great function. And in our Zen stories, it's not always so clear what it is that's helping. Another of our ancestors asked his teacher, you know, all these stories about our ancestors, it seems like what they do is just like everyday tea and rice. Isn't there something else they do to help people? And his teacher says, well, do the commands of the emperor in his own realm depend upon some ancient kings? You tell me. And when the student starts to speak, he gets smacked by the whisk. And the teacher says, before you ever left home, you deserved a beating. And the student woke up. So it may be a little difficult to look at that story or any such story and see what was helpful. But in that instance, at least, you could say the teacher's words and gestures push the student back into the embrace of all those hands that he could not see or count. So I don't know if it's this is if among the in instructions, the many, many instructions that Reverend Hokai and his colleagues received, I guess probably nobody said, okay, well, you get to the door of the room and you leave everything outside. Did anybody ever say that?
No.
No. So you'll have to say that when you're a supervisor. Now that might generate some blank looks, but on the other hand, some people might say, oh, right, I was frantically looking for all the stuff to bring into the room with me. Thank you for relieving me of that burden. And then you and go in and say, okay, who's here? What's happening? Are they asking for anything? Are they asking me to get the hell out, as happened to Reverend Hokai on at least one occasion? So the present hands and eyes manifest the whole works. That is always so. And to the degree that maybe we can resist the sort of the karmic temptation to rush off in some direction and just be present with the whole works, then maybe what is helpful manifests. Yun's Dharma grandson was named Yunju, and when he was being a hermit, a rather obnoxious exponent of the Linji school came to visit and asked him, how about when a question is used as a screen? Relating this story, Yunju said, at the time, my mind was sort of slow and dull, so I didn't say anything. And the obnoxious Linji school person said, Well, hermit, I don't think you can answer that question. I think you'd better bow and withdraw, which is, like, it's really a nerve telling that to the person when you're the visitor. So this chap, Xinghua was his name, somebody who had been to visit Yunju later went to see Xinghua and told him that Yunju had related this story. Xinghua said, boy, after 20 years, he still doesn't get it. Actually, when Yunju tells the story, he said at some point he realized nothing is needful here. That would have been a good answer. In fact, he knew that at the time. But He didn't say. And in the style of our house, oftentimes we don't say. We can let the other gang do most of the shouting. And we can fall back into the embrace of a thousand hands. I'm sorry if I'm keeping some of you up. It's my job. During one sesshin, my teacher said, he apologized for giving a Dharma talk, and he said he noticed that a lot of people were having trouble sleeping during his talk. So he said he was very sorry. Some other Zen worthies have speculated. See, which is it? Is it throughout the body? Is it all over the body? And what's the difference anyway? If it's really the great function, difference is irrelevant. So, to make a already too long story short, that's how we help people. And you know, to enter the room, so to speak, leaving everything outside so thoroughly that you even leave the leaving outside. That requires what we call faith or trust. And eventually, that kind of trust really does become everyday tea and rice. Whether we think so or not, spring enters the branches effortlessly, and the moon crosses the sky unhindered. This really is how things are. So remember to rejoice. Once in a while. Just remember, throughout the body, hands and eyes, but don't go looking for them. You have some questions?
I have a couple. The first one, the act of listening and in trying to interpret what's the best way to help someone, you may often encounter a person who is belligerent or difficult and, or has mental health issues.
Oh, yes.
So sometimes you sort of need to use your training or your intuition or other, and maybe that's just a different form of listening. Is that what you would say?
It could be, yeah, for sure. The question would be, can I relate to my training, for instance, in a way that actually doesn't hamper me, doesn't tie me up? Then sure.
Yeah.
You know? I don't know if this is a good example exactly, but periodically over at Beginner's Mind Temple, someone would show up who's in a kind of eccentric orbit, you might say. And there was one young woman who would show up, and often during the Dharma talk would begin to abuse the speaker. So, you know, got to the point where she would come to a Dharma talk and everybody would go, oh, here it goes again. And one time, Reb was speaking. And I don't remember exactly how it came to this, but at some point he got up from the speaker's seat and kind of walked towards her and said, okay, I'm coming to play with you now. And she was like, no, get away from me. And so she got up and he said, no, I'm coming to play with you now. And then she ran out of the Buddha hall and ran up and downstairs. You could hear Red going, I'm coming to play with you. And she's like, no, get away. Finally, she ran out the front door. And not too long after that, she appeared one day. At that point, she was asked not to come back. But after a while, she came back at one point and she was very calm. And she said, can I come back now? And we said, yeah. And it was okay. So I'm not advising that you take that particular tack, but it was made for quite an interesting Dharma talk, I must say. And it seemed to function in the situation. So, you know, was that in Reb's training? No, it wasn't.
I'm dealing with a person who is severely depressed and is scaring me to death, so
yeah.
I don't really know what I've been struggling with, what to do other than, you know, bringing up the Dharma, talking about our ability to use our mind as an ally and not just
mm-hmm.
as an enemy. But it's been a real struggle.
Yeah. Have you tried the so-called Ministry of Presence?
That's, yeah, yes.
That's actually sometimes the only thing that will serve. You're totally there with the person, and
yeah.
That's it. And it may involve, you know, a gentle touch, or maybe not, but to convey that you are absolutely there with them is sometimes tremendously healing. Even if the person doesn't quite realize that's what's happening, you can actually tell with the passage of some time that there was a beneficial effect. I would say that's probably at the top of it's not a technique exactly, it's one of the finest gifts one can give to someone who is in an extreme state. And again, it can be scary because one also feels oneself to be maybe vulnerable or exposed or helpless. So if under those circumstances we can again fall back into those hands, like reaching for the pillow when it's totally dark, you then help will be available. Anyway, thank you for doing that.
Well, I monopolized, but my other question was, I understand, I can get the nothing is lacking teaching.
Right.
But the world is perfect as it is.
Uh-huh.
It's a bit more struggle, a bit more of a struggle for me. But,
yes. Yeah.
If you said the world is as it needs to be, I could sort of get it.
Yeah.
But the world is perfect as it is, it's a real struggle.
Yeah. That's a tough one. And if it's not useful, it's okay to set it aside. But I personally see how that's so. And yet, the occasions where that's actually helpful to say are very few. Maybe if you're with some other, you know, Zen lunatic, you can trade cute little aphorisms like that, and it'll be fine. But most of the time, that teaching doesn't fit, and it will upset people or put people off in a way that isn't helpful. So,
kind of reminds me of that Christian teaching, you know, that it's all in God's plan.
Oh, that one.
Oh, that
yeah, it's similar. Mm-hmm. It's quite similar.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you know how to relate to that is, you know, it's non-trivial. And that teaching also can be, and is often, misapplied, and provokes rejection on the part of people. Like, what's his name? Stephen Fry, who I really like. He's a really great guy. And he's definitely not religious. And he said, so how exactly is a child with bone cancer in God's plan? And that's a very good question. Now, some people think, oh, you know, that's just how it is. And for some people, their genuine faith and trust is such that that's okay for them.
Mm-hmm.
But for many people, that won't work. So, you know, sometimes the teaching is sometimes described as the poison drum. Have you heard that expression? Supposedly, I guess Indian mythology, although I don't remember this very clearly. A particular kind of drum, if you smear it with poison, when you beat the drum, whoever hears it dies. And this is a metaphor for how the teaching can be dangerous, actually, and not helpful, and has to be used very, very carefully. And it may be that the teachings that depend on emptiness are perhaps the most dangerous and most easily distorted.
I just want to echo on what
Jim.
Yeah. Why are we here, really? What do you think?
Here?
Yeah. Like, are we here because of our karmic cravings? Or are we here to end that? Like, in that perspective, the outlook is kind of grim, like, whoa, then maybe the world is the hell, you know?
Mm.
It is really messed up in hell, and quite frankly, we made up, oh, this is like a wonderful thing, or you know, you shouldn't be having such, all this nonsense talk, really.
Mm.
But from a perspective of practice, it really brings up the question on craving, and ending
craving.
Crave,
uh-huh.
You know, with this, that we can have this automated craving.
You mean craving Zazen? No.
Craving for something that we want to have a security and,
oh,
and permanence, whatever.
Yeah.
Tanha, right?
Tanha, yes, or Trishna. Right?
Yeah,
craving.
One of the main hindrances.
That's a biggie.
From their perspective, I just don't see it. It's really a wonderful, amazing place to...
The world.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I'm able to make a room for that so I can function and live,
uh-huh,
you know.
That's what most of us do. To take the world on, you might say, the terms that are presented to us as children and that we grow up accepting, for instance, that the greatest goods are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. I mean, if you asked any particular person, how's that working for you? You know, they might be in a situation where it's like, well, I got a great boyfriend and a great job, and
mm-hmm,
I love my apartment. It's like, okay, and you know, that's good until that isn't the case anymore. Right? And then something else about our existence is revealed. That's what Buddha was pointing at.
Mm-hmm.
So, as we know, craving is rooted in ignorance or wrong view. The notion that life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness is something that you can have. That's like virtually a possession. And to try to overlook the dynamic of suffering and its cause and its ending is a big mistake. So I would say we're here because we noticed something of the sort.
What?
We noticed that that's actually so, that ignoring the existence of profound unease and its cause and its ending, to ignore that is a prescription for misery. So I think that's why we're here. Now, again, if we walk out in the street and try and convince someone else that their problem is they're ignoring misery, might provoke a rather sharp response. Yes?
Does that knowledge affect how you walk in the room?
Yeah, I would say so. For instance, I don't know if maybe a very beginning chaplain might know that, okay, in this room is a family watching their 8-year-old daughter die of cancer. So I'm going to try and put on a happy face, you know, or something like that, right? Adopt some posture to bring into the room and shed light on everything. It's like, in that's probably a beginner's mistake. Would you agree?
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah, you never say like, "Oh, this is God's plan," or "This is how it, you know." It
can't work very well.
You have a place of privilege. You're not the one who's dying or suffering.
Of course, sometimes they tell you that, don't they?
Sometimes
once in a while,
if you ask about their faith, they might have that.
Yeah, they might.
But you have to realize that you have a sense of privilege, and you're not the one sick or dying.
Yeah. Yeah. Quite.
So it's very arrogant to say, "Oh, it's all part of God's plan."
Uh-huh.
Or yeah, rejoice, you know.
Yeah. Yes, there's a time for rejoicing, and maybe this isn't it. Yeah. Anyway, Buddha was pretty clear that the issue of dukkha is determinative for sentient beings. There is no way around it. There is no escape, quote unquote. So the best thing to do is to face it squarely. and let that transform your life.
Yeah.
And well, maybe not so easy, but it's also not impossible.
Yeah.
And to become acquainted with how deep and still the body-mind is very helpful that way. So we come and we sit and become acquainted with that depth and that stillness, although again, you can't lay hands on it. So, I'm sorry, that's the way things seem to be wired.
Is craving being used in this dialogue in the same, with the same meaning as desire?
Pretty much.
In all its manifestations?
In all its manifestations, insofar as desire is rooted in a mistaken view, yes. In that formula that Buddha often used, thirst, this craving, this desire seeks its satisfaction now here and now there. Endlessly searching. It's the craving for life, craving for sense experience, and he said, and the craving for extinction. So, many centuries before Freud, Buddha acknowledged there is a craving for extinction. Yeah, so that was his tremendous discovery.
By extinction, you mean sort of in modern terminology, maybe like a craving for oblivion?
Yeah, exactly. Okay. End it all. End it all. I am fucking fed up. End it. Of course, Buddha said, turn it off. And Buddha said, unfortunately, it doesn't work that way. There is no off switch. Okay? Not really. You can, so to speak, you can depart from samsara. He said there is a way to do that. But that's not the craving for extinction. The craving for oblivion and the thought of enlightenment are not the same thing. So again, if you know someone who is contemplating suicide, it may or may not be helpful to tell them, oh, don't bother, you'll just come back again. That may not be good news. Or it might be, you know. No, anyway, it's 11 o'clock and I'm sure you want to sit a little more. And maybe by afternoon the sun will be out. And you can go enjoy yourself innocently like a child would. It's still possible for us. May or may not be back to sit with you, I'm sorry. But I will be back for the noon, short noon service. Thank you all for being here this morning.